This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey, everyone. I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
I'm Bill Cloud, Assistant Chief Medical Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Well, folks, we are very excited. We have a returning guest, Dr. James Korndorfer, and we are going to be talking around the subject of simulation labs. But before we jump right in to talk about simulation labs, Dr. Korndorfer, if you would, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and about your background.
First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity. I thoroughly enjoyed the last time, and this is the topic that's really near and dear to my heart, having been involved in simulation really for, since about 2003, so 22 plus years at this point in time. Brief background, I did my medical school at the University of South Florida in Tampa. Residency was at Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte. I was actually in private practice for 8 years before I went back in the academic route, where I was at Tulane for 13 to 14 years. And while there, I helped build our simulation center. I was the program director and vice chair of the department. I then was recruited out to Stanford to be the inaugural vice chair for education, specifically within the department, and also ran our simulation center out there as well. Finally, actually about 2 months ago now, I just took my new position here at University of Texas Austin Dell Medical School as the vice dean of education. And with that, we are actively looking at how to build out simulation and immersive learning here to try and help all learners in the Austin area.
Jim, I'll go ahead and start the questions with, you know, I think Brad and I talked about before you got on that when people talk about sim labs and healthcare, I think everybody thinks they know what that means. So tell us what that means to you.
Yeah, you know, Bill, that's changed over the years if you really think about it. In short, what you need to think about is this, is it is a way of practicing. And that could be any number of things. It doesn't necessarily mean people often think of practicing as like a surgeon practicing before they do an operation or things of that sort. But what it is it's a way of making sure that you get the best you can be before you put the patient in the system. And so that could be any number of things if you really think in a broader area. Now, in the distant past, what that meant and the real push for simulation in medicine, if you think about it, was really ATLS and, or excuse me, ACLS and BLS, where you had the Recessa Ante. I mean, that is simulation, whether you think about it or not. And that was what we thought of simulation, quite frankly, in medicine for a long, long time. I think with the advent of laparoscopy, then sort of realizing there were a lot of adverse events occurring as people were learning laparoscopy, that there was a need to try and simulate that, to try and improve people, to really create what someone's framed the pre-trained novice, if it were. But to me, simulation has gone well beyond that now. I mean, that's sort of the early stages. And I think we have an opportunity when you start talking about virtual reality, augmented reality, all these kind of things, to where we can really start creating systems to simulate and have more than just the physician involved, whether those be nurses, whether those, quite frankly, in the hospital environment. So I think, you know, nowadays, think about it as, and I like the term, an immersive learning environment. And that really is, because when people think simulation, they think of, the other thing I've heard is that sort of the practice on plastic. You know, simulation is well beyond that now. That may have been what we started with, but the opportunity to create that immersive environment to improve patient care, I think, is really the direction we need to head.
So you're going to be involved really at the University of Texas in Austin at creating this. What are the steps that you're going to look at to help create that immersive learning environment? You know, your past as an engineer may inform those steps, but just to create the learning environment, regardless of what type of learning you're trying to improve, what are the steps that should be gone through to create it?
Yeah, great question. And my basic answer is, I don't think we really know yet as we're trying to build it out 3 to 5 years from now. What I can say is I did learn quite a few steps when I built the one in New Orleans at Tulane. We were very fortunate that one of the benefactors gave a building, and we were given an entire floor of that building to create the simulation center there in New Orleans. And I had an opportunity to run that from walls up to the point of filling the whole thing out and filling out with respect to employees and the like. The one thing I learned very quickly from that is, and it was relatively novel at the time, was to engage all the learners you thought that were going to be there. It is very much of a not field of dreams where if you build it, they will come. You know, and so many places tended to buy the flashing lights and the great sound and things of that sort that nobody knew how to use. So the curriculum really ought to drive the simulation, the immersive learning environment. So I think you need to take a step back. Number one is get your stakeholders involved and identify what it is they want to use it for. For example, is it for team training? Is it for potentially training hospital onboarding? Is it, quite frankly, from you mentioned engineering, is it to have a makerspace in there to where, you know, like for here where we have an opportunity to have a world-class school of engineering, a biomedical engineering available to where we don't have to rely on what is there now, but make things better, right? Are you going to use it for patient safety and evaluate things for root cause analysis, for example? So you have something occurring in the hospital. Do you go through and evaluate what really went on, what happened to try and do that? So you really do have to take those first steps is identify the curricular needs of what you're trying to accomplish with this entity. Without that, I do believe you're going to fail. And that informs all the rest of the steps, quite honestly.
You know, that's a fascinating concept to use it for root cause analysis, because one of the things I think we've hit on is that, you know, one of my responsibilities is quality improvement for the system. Mm-hmm. And let's say we have a series of faults. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a potential where we can create an environment where we say, all right, what does the environment look like from the patient perspective, from the nursing perspective? You know, where is the bed? Where is the door? How can we actually create a better fall prevention environment looking at what, you know, the current condition, what we have now?
Exactly.
Have you done some of that in your past?
Yeah, we did. We did a couple of initial pilot projects to do that. And started out, the first step was to see a proof of concept. And it's very fortunate that the doctor's company, which is one of the medical malpractice companies, they actually funded this for us initially, to where we had access to some of their closed claims. And we were able to model the events that occurred in the simulation environment. Because our interest was this, is like, you know, would it recur at all or not? And the fascinating thing, when we did it on the initial phase in a retrospective fashion, we in fact were able to have the event recur again. Now, it didn't have to recur every time, so we ran physicians through that, but it in fact did occur again. And so then we took it a step further. It's like, well, if we can make something to where, create a simulation to where these events would occur, or at least it would occur sometimes, then can we take something even more prospectively, something that just happened, again, something we're going through, a root cause, and try and figure out the true root cause, right? Because I'm sure there are plenty of hospitals and places that do root cause analysis great. Don't get me wrong. But it sure does seem like most of the time, at the end of the day, everybody's sitting around that table, you know, they have their rose-colored glasses or their rearview mirror glasses on. And at the end of the day, it usually comes down to one thing. And that is, well, what did the person do wrong? You know, and nobody in there walked in today trying to do something wrong, but it did happen. And it usually is the person connected with that environment, as you're describing. And so what we did was this. We had an event that occurred that, interestingly enough, was when they did their root cause analysis, it was that, and we had a published paper on this, so it's, but in short, that they determined that the nursing needed to do more vital signs checking in a particular area. Well, when we actually did the simulation, we did it, I believe, 8 times, and I may be a little off. 6 of the times, the exact same thing happened again. Well, what it turned out was that it wasn't that the nurse wasn't taking vital signs. It's like they had no system of who they were supposed to contact in this particular environment at the time. And so instead of creating another policy, which unfortunately is the easiest thing to do, right? You know, I've seen some foreign body policies in ORs, 17 pages long now. Because if things happen, you add to the policy. Nobody ever reads that, right? But then we did it. We took it a step further. Is that we use that, interview the people that did things and that caused the event to occur, and also talk to the people that, when they're in the simulated environment, that did the things that prevented it from occurring. And we put something into place, in other words, a solution into place, again, in the simulation environment. And this is what's so important, because when we did that, the issue never occurred except for one time, and that was for an entirely different reason, because the phone system didn't work, right? Now, if you think about it, there are two things that are great there. One, we had the opportunity to test your actions, again, before we ever put a real patient in an environment. Because unfortunately, I'm sure there have been plenty of times where, and I remember somebody telling a story at one of the Team Steps programs that I was at. I don't know what hospital it was. It doesn't really matter. But they looked at, they had several events occurring. I think it was a foreign body. It was a lost specimen and a couple other things. And they seemed totally unrelated. But when they really looked at it, what had happened is that they were trying to enhance their turnover time. So unfortunately, the circulator was always leaving the room, getting ready for the next thing. And so these things occurred. And so the idea of putting, using simulation to put these new or just planned ideas into place, you can then identify what are some of those other effects that you never would expect to have happen. And so that's where I think there is a tremendous opportunity. So yeah, we haven't really gone a whole lot further, because as you can imagine, it's exceedingly expensive to do this kind of things. You know, it's nurses' time, because you had to have people. We weren't having people just playing nurses. We had the nurses from that particular unit coming in doing this. We had the physicians that were using that unit coming and doing it. So, you know, it is a monetary issue when you're trying to scale this. But I think we have shown that it certainly does work.
Dr. Korndorfer, this is very interesting. And you've talked about several things that we really spend a lot of time talking about in our improvement system at Baptist, whether it's ways of practicing or creating systems. Those are things that we're talking about all the time. One thing I want to kind of dive into is I think physicians probably do this well. I'm thinking about several ways that, you know, physicians and vendor partners find ways to practice. I think nursing has done this well. But one of the things that you piqued my interest on is engaging all learners. Mm-hmm. Have you had some experience in pulling in other members of the team, be it patient care assistants or surgical techs or even EVS staff, into the simulation process?
Some. Again, it sadly enough oftentimes goes back to, it's a cost thing, right? Because if you're bringing those individuals in, the system that's going to do it has to see the value, because they're paying for those individuals to do things that don't directly, I think it does indirectly, but don't truly very directly affect their bottom line, right? That nurse is no longer taking care of a patient on the floor, so you're now paying for two nurses during that 2 hours. You're paying for that scrub tech otherwise. That said, you know, certainly, yes, we've been able to be successful in doing that and had scrub techs involved, because at the end of the day, you know, medicine is a team sport now. You know, this whole concept of the distant past of there's a captain of the ship kind of thing, you know, we can't do it all. We don't know it all. And without that team around you, and it's the team performance that really is the thing that makes a difference all the way through for the final concept of patient care. And so if we don't learn as a team and don't practice as a team, we're not necessarily going to be successful. So yes, we have been able to do that some. It is a challenge. And again, it's a monetary challenge. But I would argue that an analogy I've used is that I don't know there would be any professional football team that if you had the quarterback that was throwing, you know, 10 yards down and 10 yards out over and over and over again to the one spot, and then at the other end of the field, the wide receiver was running 10 yards and 10 yards out, but they never got on the field together. I don't think they're going to do really well when they're on the field for real. And I think that's the challenge we do have, is that we do tend to continue to train separately. And again, I do understand the economic pressures of it. It does exist. You know, they talk about, well, airline industries do that? Yeah, but they're required to, right? There's a mandate. And I'm not sitting here saying that we need to create an unfunded mandate either, okay? Because that's, I know nobody out there that's listening that wants to hear that. And
yeah,
I, and
those
I would
are popular,
agree with that.
Right? Yeah.
Right. That's not a popular thing. But are there ways that certain systems could look and see where they can do these kind of things? And I think as certain systems do that and they show the value, then I think you might get that snowball effect to where other places see the true value to their, not only to their patients, but eventually to their bottom line.
Jim, do you have other leaders from other disciplines who you have collaborated with or who you plan to collaborate with? As you talked about all learners,
yeah.
Have you begun the process of identifying who might be collaborating for this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the fortunate thing I have here is we have, you know, have a school of nursing, a school of pharmacology, social work, all of these. So I think, you know, any and all of those learners, I think, are critical to be involved. But I would actually take it a step further. As I'm looking at trying to build things out, you know, the people I want to get involved are even ones that aren't even in medicine at all right now. They're people, you know, we talk about airline industry and, you know, they talk about that all the time. It's like, well, you know, they use it regularly. It's like, you know, what people don't understand is the first airline simulator, which was I think it was called the Link simulator, was built in the 1920s. So they've been doing this for 100 years. You know, realistically, you know, again, except for the recessive anti type thing, we've been doing this for about 20 years. So they're way ahead of us. So the point being is that I think getting those people involved, getting engineers involved, getting nuclear industry that certainly does a lot of simulation, offshore oil industry, there are all sorts of industries that utilize it perhaps, I won't say better, but differently than we do in medicine. And so, yes, as I start thinking how to create these kind of things, I think we need to rely on those kind of individuals to help us toward moving toward the future. But then get all the people I just mentioned that are touch points in that facility are the ones that need to also be involved. And I think that would be a unique milieu that we can create something special.
Yeah. So I'm interested in, you mentioned this a little bit in your intro, but today with the technologies that we have, I'm interested if you'll talk a little bit about kind of virtual environments and what you're seeing there and what you're kind of experimenting with as far as, you know, the technology we have at our disposal today.
Yeah, I think the opportunity is huge. I don't think we've had we haven't really taken advantage of it yet. It's moving in that direction and people understand that. And part of it has to do with the airline industry as an example. Okay, you know, that's a virtual environment that they use and they've been using a virtual environment all the time. But it's pretty easy to create that virtual environment, right? It's like the people that created the plane, oh, by the way, also created the virtual environment. Mm-hmm. Second to that, it is very easy to understand that 737, whether it is blue and red on the tail from United versus orange and was it yellow for Southwest, the plane is going to function the exact same way. So you only have to make one, right? The challenge with simulation, even in a virtual world, is, you know, how many do you need to make? In other words, if I were taking your gallbladder out, it would be different than taking somebody else's gallbladder out. It's not, doesn't look exactly the same. Is it inflamed? Is it, you know, normal? Does it have multiple stones? You know, these kind of things, exactly where it is. Various anatomic variations, which are critical in a surgical world to make sure you're aware of. So the challenge has always become in this arena, and I do believe this is where we're going. I think as computing gets much better and continues to grow exponentially, these things can occur. But it makes it challenging in a virtual world even to figure out what virtual world you want to create, is I guess what I'm getting at. How much is enough? You know, when I cut something, does it in fact bleed? And okay, how can I control it in a virtual environment? Early on, in the very early days, while the virtual world worked well for helping people learning, there was actually a great paper that kind of started the simulation world in surgery to some extent, which is it was called VR to OR, is what it's effectively called, but by Neil Seymour, which looked at having somebody practice on the virtual laparoscopic simulator and then did show improvement in the operating room. go a step further is like what we call our video trainers, meaning kind of real things, not necessarily tissue, but real things. People tended to prefer it more than they did the virtual environment. Again, those were early days of the virtual, and we've changed tremendously since then. A good example of, I think, one of the virtual environments simulation works well, but you can imagine the reason why this works, is in robotic simulation. But there again, you're dealing with really in essentially two dimensions, right? I mean, you're using the same instruments, but what you're seeing on the screen is, I know it's technically a three-dimensional screen what you're seeing, but just bear with me, it's still a screen you're looking at, right?
That's right.
And that's where, if you think about it, all the simulators that have procedural simulators that have continued to improve in a virtual world, most of them were those that we dealt with in a two-dimensional setting. The endoscopy simulators that are out there are very good. The ones for radiology are also quite good because it's a lot easier to deal with. Now, the problem there becomes if a company wants to create something, and this is, again, kind of, I hate to bring it back to money again, but if a company wants to develop something, and let's say they develop the perfect simulator to teach somebody how to do an operation, all right, or several operations. Well, right now, I think almost all residencies would love to have that. Well, there are what? I don't know how many, 312 surgical residencies in the U.S. now. That number keeps changing all the time. Whereas that same company uses the same concept and they build a perfect video game, Grand Theft Auto, they're going to sell millions of them. So again, it's a challenge there of you know, how much effort is being put into this from a company side to really use these tools that we have. And so that's why I do think it's going to be us, those sitting on this call right now, or this podcast, are going to have to somehow drive that within our own systems, with our own opportunities with engineers and otherwise, to show where we need to go with it. But definitely a need, definitely opportunity. I don't think we've even scratched the surface into what we can use it for long term.
Yeah, and so I think the cost pressures that you speak of are very real, and I appreciate you bringing that up. How are you tackling that in your new role?
I've been here 2 months. I'm just learning the lay of the land right now. I'm not willing to even go there right now. I don't know yet.
I understand.
Don't know.
Well, Jim, as you may imagine, you know, Skip's background was in industry, and so you know, in industry, he says, you know, we have model lines and we have these areas where we can safely experiment and do interventions and see what the outcome is.
Right.
And I think one of the challenges for us in healthcare was how true to reality does the environment have to be in order for it to transfer, you know, the knowledge to transfer. And maybe for preventing falls, you know, it'd be pretty easy to create a patient's room and put a bed in it and all those places. There are going to be bigger challenges than that. But, you know, so that was the origin of this, is how can we use the principles behind simulation and immersive environments to prevent things that commonly recur that we find that we need to improve on?
Yeah. Again, I think the opportunity to try and figure out why they happen is so critical. And I think that in that setting, you probably do need something relatively realistic, right? Because whether that's a simulated realism or actually doing it in situ in the real hospital, and those are opportunities as well. So it really kind of, Bill, it depends on what you're trying, again, go back to the curriculum, it's really trying to accomplish. I think if you're trying to teach somebody how to get a little bit better, and I'm going back to surgery since that's what I do, suturing, you don't need anything fancy. I mean, let's face it, we did that on grape skins, for heaven's sakes, right? And it worked fine. I don't think there's any doubt that tying practice knots over and over on the on-call bedpost, excuse me, made us better and quicker at doing those things. That's still simulation if you think about it. So it really does depend on what that level of result you're looking for, I think, drives. And then it gets back to what I said at the very beginning. Well, your curriculum really needs to drive what you're doing. I would argue it also needs to drive what your environment is. You know, I think it'd be wonderful to have an entirely simulated hospital somewhere where, you know, people could come and practice things, and you could, with the VR world, you can change the way the hospital looks inside it, right? And you could have individuals that could come and, from an industry standpoint, is look some of the industry things they're building and creating, and put them in the environment with the quote patient before we ever put it in the real environment. So, and again, that gets back to the monetary side. And I think if you can create that kind of environment, you may have a way of perhaps funding it. In other words, it's funded to somewhat on the back of industry, but not really, because they're getting something out of it, right? They get to test their things with real people, with real things, to find out, you know, does this really work or not? So I know that's not really it doesn't give you a complete answer, but it's just one of those things where the realism does matter, but we often call in the world of simulation that idea of suspended disbelief, right? And that's critical as well, because, and that starts with, okay, you're going into this environment, treat it as if it is real. And so there's a big part of that too, as far as the mindset of the people going through this. If they think they're playing, then they're just going to act like they're playing, and they may not do what they really try, you know, you would really expect. So it does take a mind shift of individuals as well. And that goes back to the culture difference. You know, I would argue that, much as we talked about pilots, people in the airline industry, these other industries, when they're going through their simulation, it matters. All right. So they're spot on. And that's going to still be a culture shift as well. I think we've gotten the culture shift of knowing that if I do some things, I'm going to get better. So it's value to me. But I don't know that we've really gotten to that culture shift of let's go through this to really analyze it and let me act like I would really act. And that's the other part we got to work on over time.
A couple more questions. When you're working through, how are you trying to discover the root cause of something? Did you videotape and then review the videos, or was this something you would take notes on real time? I mean, how did you assess that?
Meaning for the hospital environment originally?
Yeah.
Like what event occurred? No, we did use events that rose to that level, and then we did a complete chart review as well as interviews of the individuals involved. So no, these were not at this point in time when we were doing this, because this was, gosh, probably almost 10 years ago now we were doing this. We did not have video, for example, in all of the ORs at this point and those kind of things. Didn't have video in the pre-op and PACU and the like. Yeah. So these were strictly chart review, build out. And then we had to practice it a couple times with just, you know, our actors, right? Meaning those of us to go through it to see, did this make sense to us before we started putting, you know, bringing the people over for doing it for real. So that's how we did that.
Yeah. The other thing I'll mention is that we have been looking at, and really for efficiency purposes, an AI-enabled camera system in the operating room.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is to timestamp events in the operating room, like wheels in, wheels out, that sort of thing. We met with a couple of organizations who already had these in place, one being yours, your ex-organization.
Right.
And so have you used those video systems to go back and review events that you've said, all right, this was not a perfect outcome. What can we learn from reviewing the video?
Yeah, not to the level it needs to be, but yes, we, in fact, prior to my leaving, we were using it for video-based M&Ms, for example, to where when things went on, you could really go in and evaluate what went on. But the other thing we did is that there were a couple of them that we looked at that were actually very good saves. I remember a couple events that occurred that it ran incredibly smoothly. And so it was looking at the system as to why it went well, you know, and, you know, perhaps it was, and I don't remember the specific issue on this one, but, you know, was it because it just so happened that the person that was needed happened to be walking by the OR at that point in time versus is somebody that's actually readily available? And again, I don't remember but we've used it for both of those. And I think that's a tremendous opportunity that we have as we go through these things, because again, nobody's in there trying to do harm, but it happened, and it's not just an individual. I mean, theoretically, yeah, sure, it could be somebody that didn't have the skill or the knowledge base they should at the time, but that just doesn't typically happen, right? I mean, it's just not a common event. It's usually the common thing are individuals coming together and figuring the situation out. So I think that's a tremendous opportunity. Have we used that much yet? No, we haven't. But I think it's a great thing because you can take that, and we have talked about doing this, and we're thinking about doing this with the simulation center before I left Stanford, was doing exactly what you're talking about, doing videotapes, for example, in the trauma bay, identifying what went well, and then using those to create the simulation and put those people in it again and again and again. So I think there's a huge opportunity to use video for that. We've basically just been using video to have the residents review it and for learning purposes more than anything else at this point. It's what I've used it for, I should say.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Korndorfer, this has been awesome. I'm actually kind of shocked that 30 minutes went by so quickly. So I'm actually going to go ahead and ask you now, would you please come back again in the future? We would like to further this conversation. We think this is fantastic what you're doing. You know, my exposure to it in industry for 20 years, I found high-tech simulation. I saw very low-tech simulation, and both of them be incredibly impactful. But on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing us your insight. We're going to be cheering you on as you get started there at Austin, and we may even be asking if we could come visit you. But this is really special and important improvement work. So once again, on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Skip, Bill, and Brad, thanks so much for having me back again. I would be more than happy to come back and talk further about this. As you know, simulation is something I've been doing for a while now, and certainly I do see the value and appreciate the opportunity. And you're more than happy to come down. There's nothing to really look at, yes, simulation-wise to speak of right now, but once we get that going, we'd love to have you down.
We'll take you up. Thank you all so much.